Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Bill Buford's new book offers a much-needed mental escape to the kitchens, bouchons, and bakeries of Lyon, France. In Dirt, Adventures in Lyon as a Chef and Training Father and Sleuth for Looking for Secret of French Cooking, Buford chronicles his five-year odyssey to master French cooking, which included moving to France with his wife and their twin toddlers. He apprenticed and befriended a local baker in Lyon to learn the art of baguette making. He studied at the prestigious L'Institut Boucou and even cooked at the Michelin-starred restaurant La Mer Brassier. Hope I said that right. Bill Buford shares his ups, downs of it all, including what he learned about the secret of French cooking, and I'm glad he joins us now to discuss. Bill, welcome to All of It.
Thank you very much, Allison.
So, Bill, I took one semester of French a very long time ago, so some of these pronunciations could be far off, but I understand you were in a similar boat when you went to France. You weren't fluent.
I think I arrived in a sinking boat. I never did a semester of French. And I learned it on the spot, was confident I would learn it on the spot, and then I didn't really learn it on the spot. I needed French training while I was in French language training in the course of finding ourselves in Lyon. Not comfortably, but ultimately really quite wonderfully.
So many people know, of course, your best-selling book, Heat, which you immersed yourself in Italian cooking and culture, and you moved to Italy, and you worked as a line cook. Why was moving to France and becoming a French-trained chef important to you?
I always wanted to be French trained. And some of that is I wanted to master cooking to an extent that I feel I could cook whatever the season presented and know the different things that I could do with each ingredient. You know, Italy is really a way of celebrating summer. With the summer, you can almost never go wrong with, you know, all your fresh fruit and your vegetables and your corn and your tomatoes. But I wanted to be able to cook all through the seasons, and a lot of that discipline is in French training. It's something I've been longing to do since forever. And having mastered some Italian cooking techniques and felt comfortable in the Italian kitchen and speaking Italian, I felt that I needed to complete my education.
How did your wife react when you presented this plan?
Well, so, you know, initially she was extremely enthusiastic because at the end of Heat, I say, you know, I've learned Italian and I've fallen in love with the Italian Renaissance, and the Italians all think they invented French cuisine. So obviously that's the next thing I've got to do. And it took me a long, long time to sort it out, mainly because I was terrified. And then I finally came up with a solution, which involved, I did an apprenticeship in Washington, D.C. with Michelle Richard, which in retrospect was perfectly absurd because we lived in New York City and we had twin toddlers and my wife was looking after them, and she didn't really understand why I had to spend Sunday night to Thursday night in another city in a hotel. Not the most arduous experience for me, but a very arduous one for her. And then I came up with a plan that we'd go over for a couple months, and then she'd go back with the boys, and then I'd go back to France and find myself in a kitchen. And she said firmly and just resolutely, no. We're not doing that. And I remember the conversation very vividly. I thought, oh, well, there goes that book idea. And I said, well, what are we going to do? And she said, we're moving there legitimately with visas, with our family. And I thought, wow, okay, that's big. And we did. It took a long time to get the visas. I have many friends who went to France, everyone from Thomas Keller to Dan Barber, who went without visas. They were just there under the radar. And I have some friends who I met who were under the radar and got caught by the police and kicked out. But we went legitimately. We went through the French consulate. We did all the paperwork. We had to get all the references. And after just weeks of bureaucracies, some clerk, some person who took our money misspelled our son Frederick's name and spelled it like it was Frederic in French. And then we had to go back and do the whole thing over again. But finally we arrived 6 months later.
That is an excellent life partner you have there to make
that
choice.
She has been correctly described by many people as a saint. She is certainly very tolerant. And she has many times wondered, how did it end up that she married me? You know, not in a positive way. But she's, without her, none of this would have happened.
My guest is Bill Buford. The name of his new book is Dirt, Adventures in Lyon as a Chef in Training, Father, and Sleuth Looking for the Secret of French Cooking. Now, why did you choose to settle in Lyon, not in Bordeaux or Paris?
Paris was the obvious place, and I'd always been thinking of Paris, and I had some chefs in mind. It was a very intimidating place, but the more time I spent in kitchens here in the U.S., in Washington, D.C., with Michelle Richard, the more people kept referring to Lyon. Paris is a cosmopolitan city. It has, you can have all kinds of cuisines there. You can have Alsatian cuisine, you have Chinese cuisine, you have Japanese cuisine. But Lyon is meant to be very, in some ways, backwards, unmodern, very French. And many people believe that the origins of French cooking itself, to a large extent, were fashioned in Lyon. I'd only been there once to change buses at 4 a.m. on a ski trip when I was living in London, and knew the city only as a place that was meant to be inhospitable. And I can remember when we finally got our visas and Jessica had this aerial view of the city and you could see where the markets were going to be and where we might live. And she said, doesn't this look wonderful? And I remember thinking, oh my God, no, it's making me sick. What are we doing?
Is there an American equivalent of Lyon, a city that you can think of? Maybe in terms of
food
culture?
Here in the States.
Yeah.
We have food culture cities. They are now compromised and certainly challenged. But there are cities where food is kind of the obsession of the population. New York mm-hmm. City is one. New Orleans is definitely one. Chicago is one. San Francisco is another one. Cities where food matters, people talk about it. They're interested in what is made. They're interested in what you can get locally. They're all very, very challenged. What makes Lyon different is that it's been, as far as we know, it's been a very serious food city for more than 2,000 years. And it has this just unique geological coincidence of mm-hmm. being next to mountains, next to a valley, two big rivers, very fertile valley, the Rhone Valley, where you get, as it happens, almost all the great wines of the French repertoire. And you have all these lakes and rivers where you eat local fish in a way that you would, I don't know where you would eat that except maybe in Canada or something like that. And it's very, very agricultural, nevertheless being a city of nearly 1 million people. It's the only major city in France that doesn't have a port. So in a way, it's the center of farming life and vineyards and agrarian practices that really go back for a very, very long time. And you can read in Rabelais, the eccentric, mad French poet, raconteur of the 16th century, they're eating many of the same things that they're eating now. These are deep, no pun, deep rooted food traditions. It was an amazing place to discover.
My guest is Bill Buford. The name of his book is Dirt, Adventures in Lyon as a Chef in Training, Father, and Sleuth Looking for the Secret of French Cooking. All right, so let's go to the trying to find the secret of French cooking. You tried to find work in a restaurant, Lyon, soon after you moved there. That did not necessarily go as well as you'd hoped. How would you describe that experience?
I was rejected. I had some tips. I had an introduction to one restaurant, and Jessica and I went there on a Sunday night on our first trip to Lyon, and it was just outright awful. I had another introduction to a great chef, Marc Vera. He wasn't in Lyon, which was problematic. He was actually at the foot of the Alps, but he was a genius. And after we met him, he first of all said to Jessica, because she was the one who spoke French at that time, and I did not, he said, yes, I'll have him in my kitchen, but he's got to speak French. And I went home resolved to learn French. In the meantime, he closed his restaurant because he had many, many maladies from an accident that he had. And so we arrived in Lyon. I had no place to go. I had a list, and I went down my list going to each place and said, hi, I've written this book. I know Italian cooking. My book, Heat, had been translated into French. I gave copies to everyone, and they just stared at it dumbly and thought, huh, Italian. Yeah. Okay. No, I couldn't get in anywhere. We were there. We had visas. We had an apartment. We even had our children in school at a Lyon public school. And I couldn't get in. And I started first by at our local boulangerie, which was, as it turns out, the famous boulangerie of Lyon, where a baker named Bob made bread that all the city used to come out, especially on Sunday mornings, to buy and eat. But I still wanted to get into a restaurant and ended up going to cooking school.
I do want to talk about Bob the Baker a little bit because you write about him so lovingly and he's vivid. I mean, the way you write about him, you can see him, you can smell him, the whole thing.
Yes.
But you write about baguettes and you write, when I made baguettes, I was astonished at both the labor and the unforgiving economy. What do you mean?
Well, yeah, I think there's probably a law governing the price of a baguette. In any case, Bob would never charge too much. And you take this tiny piece of dough and you shape it and you let it rise and you go through a second rising and then you cook it and then it takes 24 hours before you can even bake it, and it's so much that goes into it. And then at the end, you get 90 centimes. You get, you know, a dollar. And he wouldn't ever charge more than that, and he wouldn't charge much more than that for his other breads, and he had many other breads. And he had this belief, which I now realize is a really old-fashioned boulanger belief, that somehow that everybody deserves good bread, that in a time of famine or hardship or difficulty, the thing that people can count on, your locals, is good bread. And there's a great tradition of Bob used to deliver his bread to restaurants in this absolutely filthy, it was the only vehicle I've ever been in where you really felt you had to bathe when you came out of it. But he would deliver his bread to restaurants. But that's a practice that goes back for years and years and years of the baker going around in the countryside, delivering his bread to local farmers. And he believed in that deeply. He was actually, in many ways, the truest, big-hearted socialist I've ever met in my life, insofar as he had an interest in the welfare of his clients. It was a beautiful thing, beautiful. And he's very proud of the bread he made.
What life lesson did you take away from Bob that you know, sometimes you meet somebody and you think about them and you know, and they'll just come into your head at a moment, something about them or something about that experience?
I think the biggest life lesson is that food can be an act of beauty and something approaching love. I mean, there's a cliche of cooking with love and blah, 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 but this is actually something much more profound. He had a responsibility to make a food that tasted of itself, that wasn't ruined by tricks, that wasn't ruined by ingredients that had been compromised by pesticides, that was in fact an agency of nutrition, and he knew his people were counting on that, and he provided that, and it was done with such soul. It's a baguette, but it's a baguette with soul. And in that it defined what making food can be for everybody on every level, whether it's making food for your family, as many of us are doing right now, or making food for your friends, or making food if you're in the hospitality business. It is such a powerful agency to respect your food to that extent. It was beautiful. I can remember a woman came in, and she always liked a Vinaigrette, and he always had to make it, and she always arrived at exactly the same time, and one day he suddenly forgot. He went, "Oh, my God!" And he rush. And then the door clinged, the bells to the door clinged, and there she was, all properly dressed, prim and proper, asking for her Vinaigrette, and Bob was able to deliver it warm, just out of the oven, and thought afterwards, almost missed that. And it's ridiculous. He's got hundreds, thousands of customers, but it's like this one customer that counted on him, and he was going to deliver her exactly what she wanted.
My guest is Bill Buford. The name of his book is Dirt, Adventures in Lyon as a Chef in Training, Father, and Sleuth. looking for the secret of French cooking. So we talked just about the gruff warmth of Bob. But on another spectrum in French cooking is that when you started working in a restaurant, in a kitchen, you wrote about how it could be downright vicious. You write about the, quote, unregulated bullying and humiliation experienced by apprentices in French kitchens, including yourself. What happened to you and how did you deal with it?
By way of explanation, I thought I'd seen in New York kitchens rough kitchen life. And I thought, well, I can't write about being on the line again because I've already written about being on the line and being a cook in a brigade and the ugliness of it, the brutality. But boy, it was nothing like a French kitchen. This was a French kitchen under stress. It was a grand kitchen that had closed down and then reopened, and finances were tight, and they were understaffed, and everybody was under pressure because they'd already got 2 Michelin stars from the moment they opened, and so they were all living up to this thing. But wow, it was tough. Some of it was the hours. We worked from 8 in the morning till midnight, except on Fridays. It was Monday to Friday, and on Fridays we'd work till 1:30 in the morning. And there would be an afternoon pause. Some people didn't take it. For me, it was completely essential, and wherever I happened to be during it, I fell asleep. But by Wednesday or Thursday, just things got tough. Someone would get thrown up against the wall, and there was a terrible episode where a young woman was a stagiaire working for a man who's a friend of mine, and he just suddenly went berserk and chased her out of the Grand Manger kitchen, which is the little kitchen where you make the starters, and into the main kitchen and started hurling pots at her head. Just swept off all the pots off the flat top and just boom, 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 boom at her head, and she was cowering, and we're all looking there just kind of stunned, and we could see he was not actually trying to hit her head. But I don't think she took any comfort from that. But there was a lot of that, including once when the same person, when I made a mistake with my artichokes, picked up all the artichokes in a box and just slammed them against the wall over and over again. And I could tell, oh, poor Sylvain, what he's really thinking is that's my head. I got bullied. I got bullied by a 19-year-old. And it culminated in me being told that I had to go hit him. And I was really surprised that I was told that. I was told that because it meant, first of all, this bullying went on for a very, very long time. And I tried to deal with it. I failed. And I tried to deal with it. I messed it up. I tried to deal with it. I got myself in a corner. And I had no idea that anybody else was noting it or was offended by it, because in the kitchen, you just tolerate this until finally someone said, you got to go hit him now. Hit him. Hit him. I thought, okay, I don't actually want to hit him. I don't like him. I kind of wouldn't be unhappy if he got hit by a bus, but I don't actually want to be the bus driver. But then I thought it would be good for my book. I suddenly remembered I'm a writer, and this is like, this is copy. Yeah, I mean, this is copy. This is what you live for. Like, okay, I don't want to hit this guy. I got to hit this guy. I mean, that's the climax. And I thought, okay, I'm going to hit him. And then I thought, oh, maybe I'll hit him later, like tomorrow. And then that didn't happen because this guy was clearly stressed. And he ended up quitting by the evening shift. And the whole kitchen was just transformed. And it became just a hard place to work, but it became a happy place to work.
Bill, what is the one, before I let you go, the one dish that you were so proud that you were able to learn?
Oh, it was a ridiculous dish. So it was called, really it's just called duck pie. It's a tourte de canard. It was a puff pastry. You take a duck and you take out the breasts and you roast them separately and you make a cider sauce for them. And then you make this pie of all the other elements of the duck meat, mainly the legs, with turnips and mushrooms, and I stuck in olives, which is a little bit of a mistake. Well, it's not really allowed. and you make a sweet cider sauce, and you bake it, and it comes out smelling like all your birthdays in one. And it's ridiculously labor-intensive, but just a beautiful creation. And it combined my understanding of meat, my understanding of French vegetables and how to cook them, and my understanding of puff pastry, which I was then making routinely. And it was a beautiful thing to make, and I entertained a lot of friends with it.
To hear more or to read more about Bill Buford's adventures, you should pick up his book, Dirt, Adventures in Lyon as a Chef in Training, Father, and Sleuth, Looking for the Secret of French Cooking. Bill, thanks for being with us.
Allison, thank you for having me.